After sitting unused for several years, the Pentagon is now sinking another $80 million into the spaceport.
The Kodiak rocket launch facility is on an Arizona senator's pork hit list. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, January 11th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, President-elect Trump taps David Shulkin as the next head of the Department of Veterans Affairs.
We have to do a better job at VA of defining what our needs are and letting Congress know.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
As it turns out, you don't need to wear a cape to save the community or a giant S on your chest to stand up for what's right. That's because the University of Alaska is working to build a better future for our state. Through education, the university is developing a skilled workforce with more teachers, engineers, and nurses to move Alaska forward. Join the university in leading the change Alaska needs. Visit drivechangeak.org to learn more. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska.
Alaska's congressional delegation cheered last year when the Missile Defense Agency awarded an $80 million contract for work at the Kodiak rocket launch facility. But in the U.S. Senate this week, that sole source contract was derided as wasteful government spending. APRN's Liz Ruskin reports the contract was at the top of one Republican senator's pork list.
Senator Jeff Flake of Arizona has taken the mantle as the Senate's porkbuster-in-chief by publishing an annual waste book. The last one had a Star Wars theme, The Farce Awakens. This time, Flake titled his book, Porkymon Go.
But instead of Pikachu, we're looking out for Porkachu.
The waste book does not lack for puns. Flake says his top entry this year, number one of 50, is the Kodiak spaceport.
After sitting unused for several years, the Pentagon is now sinking another $80 million into the spaceport. This is despite the fact that it's not even equipped with the type of missiles the DOD plans to launch for the site.
Last summer, the Missile Defense Agency awarded a sole source contract to the Alaska Aerospace Corporation for an indefinite number of launches and range support services. It could pay as much as $80 million over 6 years, but MDA won't use the existing launch facility and will instead bring its own launch equipment. Senator Flake reviewed the history of the spaceport, which benefited from earmarks the late Senator Ted Stevens was able to wring from Congress over objections from some in the Pentagon. As Flake recounted, an Army employee who pushed for the project later admitted to receiving kickbacks from defense contractors.
A mid-level DOD employee who was sentenced to prison for masterminding the plot eventually confessed that building the launch facility, quote, doesn't make sense.
And then Flake moved on to slamming the National Comedy Center in New York, which received $1.7 million in part to create holograms of dead comedians. Senator Dan Sullivan, a member of the Armed Services Committee, didn't think much of Flake's critique.
It's what happens when senators who don't know anything about missile defense take to the floor.
Sullivan put a plug for the Kodiak facility in the defense bill last month. He calls Alaska the cornerstone of missile defense, citing its position on the globe and its many military assets. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Today, President-elect Donald Trump announced his nominee for the next cabinet secretary to lead the Department of Veterans Affairs. Dr. David Shulkin is currently the undersecretary for health in the VA, making him the organization's third in command. And back in the summer of 2015, when Shulkin was just a few weeks in the job, he came to Alaska as part of an official field hearing in Eagle River, hosted by Republican Senator Dan Sullivan. At the time, Shulkin said the VA was facing issues that mirror structural health care problems in the nation at large and needs to focus on finding resources to handle an aging veteran population.
We have to do a better job at VA of defining what our needs are and letting Congress know what we need to be able to do to take care of the veterans of this country who've served our country. But it may be that with better projections that we actually do need more resources.
Before coming to the VA, Shulkin's worked for several large private research hospitals. In a press release, Senator Sullivan, who serves on the Veterans Affairs Committee, says he looks forward to continuing to work with Shulkin, but remains unsatisfied with how the VA is serving former service members. Alaska has the highest per capita rate of veterans of any state in the country. The Water Infrastructure Improvements for the Nation, or WIN Act, and the National Defense Authorization Act both contain independent sections regarding an Arctic deep water port. Senator Dan Sullivan says that's intentional.
You know, sometimes you do that thinking that, you know, maybe one of these bills doesn't become law. The good news from our perspective is that both bills became law. And so our 1-2 punch actually worked on the econ and national security side because both bills actually made it through the, you know, rather lengthy process of becoming a law. And so I think we're set up pretty darn well.
The Army Corps of Engineers announced a plan in February of 2015 to expand Nome's outer harbor from 22 to 28 feet deep. And Nome was in the process of completing that feasibility study when things got put on hold.
If you remember, when Shell pulled out of Alaska, the Corps used that as a reason to stop doing the evaluation. So we said, no. You can't just base it just on that. You can base it on national security as well.
Added criteria now include humanitarian relief, search and rescue, disaster, and oil spill response.
And, you know, I convinced my colleagues in the Congress that, hey, whether the Pentagon supports it or not, this makes sense for America. So let's do it. And we did do it. So we were able to get into the law, even though the Department of Defense wasn't terribly enthusiastic about it.
If officials conclude a strategic defense port is necessary, the Act states they have until December 2018 to submit the proposal to designate where it would be. Interior Secretary Sally Jewell has designated 24 U.S. sites as new National Historic Landmarks, including one in Alaska. Jewell announced the designation today of the Walrus Islands Archaeological District near Togiak. A department announcement says it's one of the few remaining places with evidence of human occupation of the Bering Sea continental shelf, where sea levels were substantially lower. When sea levels were substantially lower, Round Island, a haul-out site for Pacific walrus, is one of the 7 islands in the district. Senators Lisa Murkowski and Dan Sullivan introduced legislation today that would authorize construction of the single-lane non-commercial gravel road between King Cove and the all-weather airstrip in Cold Bay. The bill would allow for an equal-value land exchange between the state and federal governments to build the road within the 206-acre corridor. The Departments of Interior under the Obama administration blocked the road's construction, citing the sensitive habitat protected in that wilderness-designated section of the Eisenbeck National Wildlife Refuge. Governor Bill Walker applauded the senators for their efforts, saying he would support the land swap and will encourage Congress and the incoming administration to move quickly on what he called a life-saving proposal. New photos show the dramatic effect of volcanic explosions on Bogoslav Island. The eastern Aleutian island is home to a volcano that has been erupting since mid-December. Now the tiny island is even smaller, and it's shaped like a hook. Chris Way Thomas of the U.S. Geological Survey says the photo also show ash on the island.
There's ash draping over everything. So there's a layer of fine, muddy-looking ash covering what was a partially vegetated island.
When all is done, Way Thomas says it's possible Bogoslav Island could be a lot smaller. He estimates about a third of the island has been destroyed so far from the eruption. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, get out your woolies, it's going to get cold.
5 to 7 days of this kind of cold in store for us, with a gradual moderation from south to north.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
If you're a rural Alaska resident, consider applying for a seat on the Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council by Friday, February 3, 2017. Applicants with knowledge of regional subsistence uses, customs, and traditions are needed. Council meetings serve as a forum for subsistence management. More at 1-800-478-1456. This message sponsored by your Federal Subsistence Board and the U.S. Departments of the Interior and Agriculture.
Alaskans aren't too surprised when the weather is cold in January, but National Weather Service Climate Science Manager for Alaska, Rick Toman, says we're going to see some extreme cold move in over much of Alaska, potentially 60 below over the western half of the state. But how far will temps drop? Toman says it's complicated.
While the air mass is going to be cold over nearly all of mainland Alaska, there is going to be the pesky problem of clouds. In areas that are cloudy, it will not be anywhere near as cold as places that are persistently clear. Now, with the cold air mass, that might just wind up meaning in, say, the eastern interior, instead of being 60 below, it may just be 35 below and snowing. It is, in fact, not true that it gets too cold to snow. It can snow even at 40 below. That happens on occasion in interior Alaska, and this could be one of those situations.
It's not exactly warm out there now, but when will the severe cold really hit?
It looks like it's really going to be not until this weekend that much of the state winds up in the deep freeze. Before that, we do have a couple of storms that will sling some clouds and snow across parts of the state. But the heart of this is really going to be over the weekend and then into early next week.
Rick, Alaskans, of course, are used to extreme cold for the most part. But is this cold snap different? Is it likely to get the attention of even sourdoughs?
That's a good question. It's been a while since we've had any real deep cold. We don't have to go back very far to find prolonged cold. January 2012 was actually a very cold month across the state. What we didn't see in that month, though, was any of the super low temperatures, say the 70 below type temperatures. But certainly there was a very sustained cold just 5 years ago. Will this meet the sourdough criteria? That's a tough call. My sense is that we might not quite get there. There may wind up being too much clouds around for the pre-1980 era cold.
Is it unlikely then that we would break any sort of records?
Record lows over most places in Alaska that have 70 or more years of records in mid-January are very, very low. I wouldn't want to say that no place would set a daily record, but it's going to. At this point, I would be somewhat surprised if we saw too many records. Back in the day, it used to get really, really cold.
How cold did it get, Rick?
Well, it got so cold. Can you imagine 38 below at Merrill Field in Anchorage? That did happen February 3rd, 1947. Downtown Fairbanks in January 1934, 66 below. The state record low, 80 below Prospect Creek in January 1971. So temperatures back in the day certainly were able to drop down there. Some places might be able to set one or two daily records, but I'd be somewhat surprised if we saw too many records fall. They're just so low.
Rick Toman is the Alaska Climate Science Manager for National Weather Service. He says it's difficult to predict how long the frigid temps will last, but 5 to 7 days are likely. He added the southeast panhandle will probably escape the extreme cold, but could see snow down to sea level. Anchorage social service agencies are coordinating efforts to provide safe shelter for people experiencing homelessness, and strategies are already in place to deal with the upcoming extreme cold spell.
A lot of great partnership is happening this winter when it comes to ensuring that men and women experiencing homelessness have somewhere to go.
That's Lisa Caldiera from Brother Francis Shelter. She says the 240-bed facility and its 20-person overflow shelter have been at or near capacity much of this winter. When that happens, BFS staff coordinate with other shelters to find beds. This year, the downtown soup kitchen Hope Center has space for 50 women. For the first time ever, Beans Cafe is open 24 hours a day, and their staff are providing overnight shelter for 50 men. Many of the overnight guests are participants in Beans' new workforce development program, but Beans' executive director Lisa Sauter says they are also making space for other overflow and for men who have mental health issues that make it hard for them to stay in larger, louder shelters.
We've had success getting people to come in and stay with us that in the past really were unwilling to come into shelter.
In previous years, Beans Cafe was used as overflow for 124 people from Brother Francis Shelter. That changed after an incident last year which caused the soup kitchen to close for 2 weeks. An injured man bled on the floor, and the blood was neither correctly cleaned up nor properly reported. Covenant House, Anchorage's only shelter for young people under 18, is also at or near capacity and has been since the summer. Executive Director Allison Keir says they are housing close to 60 young people every night and helping their older clients connect with other shelters instead. Caldiera says this year's bed capacity is similar to previous winters. Brother Francis Shelter in Kodiak is the only shelter available to members of the homeless population there, and therefore the only escape from the town's recent nighttime drops in temperature. Brother Francis Director Monty Haver says the key to keeping everyone alive during cold winter nights is flexibility. He says the current policy is that if a person has been at the shelter for 30 days, they must be sober to use the shelter facilities. But if the weather is bad enough, the night supervisor may allow the person to enter.
Basically, what I tell my guys is I can fix a lot of things, but I can't fix dead. So our goal for the last 26 years, we've been blessed to have not had somebody die due to exposure. Our goal is to, make sure that we don't lose anybody due to the elements.
Haver says that staff may isolate an intoxicated person, or if their behavior calls for it, turn them over to the police, who can give them shelter from the bitter wind in the local jail. That's standard wintertime policy. 23 cases have been opened by the American Red Cross of Alaska after their visit to the community of Savoonga in western Alaska last week after a series of winter storms damaged buildings throughout St. Lawrence Island. The Red Cross says one home was listed as destroyed, while 22 homes were noted as having major damage. That determination means repairs will need, quote, significant financial investment. The Red Cross says financial assistance was provided for all 23 cases, with further help still available for Savoonga residents. A total of 127 people received aid from the Red Cross, whose final disaster assessment cites the need for replacement of siding, roofing, and insulation on multiple homes. The driver of a diesel fuel tanker truck lost control of his rig on Monday and wrecked in a remote spot on the Richardson Highway south of Paxson, spilling some 4,000 gallons of diesel fuel. And now officials with the Fairbanks-based trucking company and the state are trying to figure out a way to remove contaminated material from the area while allowing traffic to pass through the narrow, winding stretch of roadway. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
State Department of Environmental Conservation responders say the truck and tanks slid into the ditch off the northbound lane of the highway. DEC spokeswoman Ashley Adamczak says that worries responders because the roadbed sits lower than the surrounding terrain.
The spill occurred on the uphill side of the road, so the likely migration pathway is both moving south along the roadway and moving west under the road.
Adamczak says that would make it difficult to remove contaminated material in the roadbed.
We can't just dig a hole in the middle of the road and look for fuel there and then start digging it out.
DEC responders say Coalville and its cleanup contractor have removed fuel left standing on the surface, and Adamczak says the wrecked truck has been taken back to Fairbanks. She says responders are now trying to figure out how to bring in heavy equipment to excavate contaminated snow, soil, vegetation, and gravel.
There isn't a pullout or another driveway or something relatively close to be used as a staging area.
Adamczak says responders now plan to begin intermittently closing one or both lanes of the highway, perhaps as early as today, to enable equipment to operate. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
Sitka's Green Lake Dam is fully restored to service, and the city is no longer using diesel fuel to generate electricity. The dam was shut down more than 84 days ago when part of the intake gate, which controls water into the powerhouse, failed during a routine inspection. The part, a hydraulic cylinder that raises and lowers the gate, was housed in carbon steel. After 35 years underwater, it corroded and began leaking fluid. The replacement hydraulic cylinder should last longer because it's housed in stainless steel. The city of Sitka owns its electric utility, which is normally 100% hydropower, combining both the Blue Lake and Green Lake dams. While the Green Lake Dam was out of commission, the city ran diesel generators during cold snaps. Utility Director Brian Bertacci says, all told, the city burned through about 80% of its diesel budget for the year. The Green Lake power plant is in serious need of an overhaul. In 2019, Bertacci says the city plans to shut the plant down for a major repair.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the 2017 statewide BP Teachers of Excellence program. Teacher nomination forms available at bpteachers.com.
Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their homes. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins leads to disease and increased medical cost. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message brought to you by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
Geologic changes typically move slow. But one glacier in Denali National Park could be moving at a decidedly unglacial pace. Scientists think it's doing something only a small amount of glaciers do, an event called surging. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Elizabeth Jenkins explains.
The Treleika Glacier last surged around 60 years ago, and experts think it's on track to do it again.
It's just exciting to see the natural world rearing up and acting crazy, doing big things.
That's Michael Loso, a physical scientist at Wrangell St. Elias National Park. His work also takes him to Denali, where the glacier is showing signs of increased movement. When a glacier's ice flows downward at a relatively accelerated rate, that's when it's surging. It will start to flatten out at the top, with more ice moving towards the glacier's lower end. Loso says, at the moment, you might not notice anything is different about the Treleika Glacier.
But if it develops into a full-blown surge, into the kind of behavior that we know it exhibited back in the 1950s, for example, you'd see a glacier that was completely transformed from what it had looked like, say, a year before.
Not all glaciers surge. In fact, Loso estimates that only a small percent in the world do, something that scientists only partly understand. And while climate change is causing Denali's glaciers to shrink, Loso says surging is different. It's more that the glacier is changing shape. Loso says that loose sediment and flowing water have something to do with it, and the behavior happens in cycles. In Treleika's case, scientists think it's about every 60 years. The upper part of the glacier thickens enough to start to move quickly.
So if I planted a lawn chair and I just sat down and I just stared at the glacier, I would be able to actually see it moving over time?
If you sat with your lawn chair and brought a tent and just watched for a few days, you would see the differences. You would see the changes. Absolutely.
Loso says that camping out on the glacier is kind of a fanciful idea, given the rugged terrain. He says scientists will be keeping a close eye on the Treleika Glacier to see if it has a domino effect. The last surge caused the Muldrow Glacier, which is connected to Treleika, to surge too. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau.
This year, a group of middle schoolers at West Homer Elementary are putting aside hockey sticks and skis in favor of a more unusual team sport, building robots. The students competed against more than 20 teams from across the state in December, winning an award for best overall team. Now they've set their sights on an even bigger prize, the Alaska State Championship. KBBI's Shayla Farzan reports.
They call themselves the Brickheads, and they're serious about robots.
I don't get why it's not working. It's like it's going too far or something.
The group of 10 sixth graders has been building and programming their Lego robot since October, and their dedication has paid off. Last month, the Brickheads were one of seven teams at the first Lego League Robotics State qualifiers to advance to the state championship. The robot they built is about the size of a loaf of bread, with small wheels and movable arms. As part of the competition, the robot has less than 3 minutes to complete a series of missions on a tabletop arena. One of the missions involves collecting Lego milk from a cow. The students program the robot to push a lever and dispense the milk. Push the lever too far, and the cow drops a load of Lego manure instead. The key, says Xander Moore, is to teach the robot where exactly to move.
I had to use a color sensor, which measures reflectant light off of a certain color, and that's how you make it follow that black line that circles the cow.
But programming is only one part of the competition. Judges also evaluate how well the team works together. Over the last few months, the Brickheads have had some tense moments. Team member Cecilia Fitzpatrick says they had to come up with a creative way to communicate with each other.
It's hard to talk when you're talking over each other, and we were getting a little bit irritated, so we invented a talking tiki.
It's a pretty simple system. The rule is, whoever is holding the little wooden statue is the one who's allowed to talk. Brickheads coach Marge Dunn says the middle schoolers are not only learning how to work as a team, they're also becoming more socially aware.
They have learned a lot about how to phrase things to sound more gracious and supportive. And that's not usually something that kids at this age have mastered. So there is a lot of learning going on, but it's not just the technical skills. It's also just the personal, social, and emotional learning that is of utmost importance.
This is Dunn's first year coaching the team. She says the students have taken complete ownership of the process.
They're the ones reading the manual. They're the ones figuring things out. They're the ones making a plan for success.
The team is now feverishly preparing for the state championship, which is scheduled for January 14th in Anchorage. In Homer, I'm Shayla Farzan.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Tyler Stupp and Margaret Diamayorbis in Nome, Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, Ann Hillman and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Kayla DeRoche in Kodiak, Ed Schoenfeld and Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau, Emily Kwong in Sitka, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Zoe Sobel in Onalaska, and Shayla Farzan in Homer. Our audio engineer is Eric Bork. Sean Dugan is our editor and producer. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Anchorage and Fairbanks to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly.
And by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, now distributing Boss Industrial Log Splitters, stocking gas and electric up to 34 ton, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. Wells Fargo, with over 13,000 ATMs and more than 6,000 branches coast to coast. For a branch location near you, visit wellsfargo.com.
The University of Alaska Southeast is open for business to all Alaskans. 2017 is your year to finish a degree and increase your earning power with online courses in business, accounting, and management. Explore the options online at uas.alaska.edu/SOM. This message sponsored by UAS.
Support for Alaska Public Media's Energy News Desk comes from Bettisworth North, Architects and Planners, and the Atwood Foundation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.